since April of 1985. This is the DX Audio Service.
As I mentioned, we have a lot of material to cover on this edition of the DX Audio Service. So here is disc number 3 for December 2014.
Radio employee charged with arson. This article is from the Eastern Arizona Courier News and was written by staff reporter John Johnson. An employee of Magic 100.7, KJIK, allegedly set the station on fire early Wednesday morning and then stuck around to watch it burn. The fire caused the station to go off the air until around noon Wednesday, according to a statement from its general manager, Dan Curtis, on the station's website. However, as of Thursday morning, its internet stream was still unavailable. Scott Lewis Wellbaum, 44, of Safford, was arrested and booked into the Graham County Jail on a charge of arson after investigation by Safford detectives. Shortly after 1 a.m., Graham County Dispatch received an anonymous call about a structure fire at the station at 1850 West Thatcher Boulevard. When officers arrived, they noticed smoke pouring out of the building and a man, later identified as Wellbaum, standing in the parking lot watching. Wellbaum was told to retreat from the area, and he informed officers he was an employee of the station, and there was a significant amount of expensive electrical equipment inside. The Safford Fire Department then responded to the scene and extinguished the fire. According to reports, Safford Fire Chief Clark Bingham advised the fire was possibly arson and that it appeared to have been set intentionally in multiple places from the inside of the building. Officers then learned the anonymous phone call about the fire had been placed at a payphone at Walmart across the highway. A Thatcher officer responded to review surveillance footage from the store and saw a man he believed to be Wellbaum approaching and used a payphone at the time of the tip. The subject was also wearing the same clothes as Wellbaum. The suspect and two other employees, who also have keys to the building, were then taken to the Safford Police Department to be interviewed. During his interview, Wellbaum allegedly became hostile toward the officers. When presented with a warrant to search his vehicle, which was also parked at the scene, Wellbaum acted as though he was going to throw a police computer and had to be talked down by an officer pointing his taser at him. As the officers were placing him under arrest, Wellbaum told the officers they were going to put a radio frequency identification chip inside him. After a short struggle, Wellbaum was handcuffed and transported to the jail, where a search revealed he was in possession of 5 green-tipped wood matches. He was then booked into the jail on a charge of arson. And speaking of fires, 3 Jim Ingstad stations in Washington State's Tri-Cities market are knocked off by a suspicious fire, says Seattle's KOMO-TV. There's evidence of forced entry at the transmitter site as somebody got through a couple of fences. That incident was early Saturday morning, and at least the stations can feel consoled that it could have been worse. The fire had died out on its own by the time the Kennewick Fire Department got there. Classic Rock Eagle 106.5, KEGX, says it appears to be a case of vandalism and possible arson. The authorities are still investigating what happened at the facility used by Eagle, Top 40 Power 99, KUJFM, Burbank, Washington, and All Sports, ESPN 1340, KJOX, Kennewick. I'm Phil Wayne for the DX Audio Service.
One way to get on the air in New York is plain old piracy. From Tom Taylor's Now Radio magazine, Tom scanned the FCC Enforcement Bureau records. This Now newsletter found multiple recent NUOs, notices of unlicensed operation, against aspiring broadcasters in New York City who haven't bothered to obtain a license. In the case of Ivan Diaz, Diaz and Associates, the commission's direction-finding gear nabbed them operating at 2 different frequencies, 89.3 and 91.9. The FCC also flags Leo Anguera for operating without a license at 94.1 from his home. Annie Polino was running at 89.7, also from a residence. And Marcos Tellez and Lorde Perez powered up at 88.1 at home in the Bronx. Other recent pirate sightings by the FCC, a church in Los Angeles operating at 88.3, Otto Hidalgo running at 88.3 in Gardena, California, and both Roy J. Burt and the Meridian Apartments in Beaverton, Oregon, tagged for an unlicensed 103.7. Then there are 2 really unusual NUOs. One for a Detroit area station in Hamtramck, Michigan, a suburb, run by Stephen Cherry, but at 1610 on the AM dial. Not a lot of AM pirates these days. And up in Keene, New Hampshire, the FCC orders Stephen Davies to knock it off. He doesn't have a license to operate at 102.5 FM, which is what an FCC agent from the Boston office heard on September 17th. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service, reporting from Minneapolis.
FCC sign-off. This story came to us from Bob Hawkins on November 16, 2014. The FCC, in a rare move, ordered WIFE-FM 107.9 in Indianapolis, Indiana, off the air, and the license was canceled on September 2nd of 1976. Ralph Strobel of Muncie, Indiana, happened to record this historic event, and it wasn't until he shared his tape with Bob in the fall of 2014 that we got to hear what it sounds like for a station to go off the air. This is truly a historic event in Indiana radio. We'll be back with the story about it after you listen to the sign-off.
To interrupt the regular programming to express their affection and admiration to a man of great courage, Mr. Don W. Burden, Chairman of the Board, a man with a dream and the strength to follow his own star and do it his own way.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final.
The time is 12 o'clock midnight. At this time, WIFE-FM leaves the air for an indefinite period of time by order of the Federal Communications Commission. We wish to express our thanks to the thousands of listeners who have enjoyed and depended on the station over the past 15 years.
WIFE-FM, Indianapolis.
According to a newspaper article, four radio stations were ordered to go off the air at 12:01 a.m. by the Federal Communications Commission in what the FCC official said was one of the harshest actions the commission has ever taken. The stations, owned by Star Broadcasting Company, lost a last-minute appeal to the FCC and the courts to remain on the air. The FCC vote was 3-2. The stations were WIFE-FM in Indianapolis, KOIL and KEFM in Omaha, Nebraska, and KISN in Vancouver, Washington. Indianapolis Broadcast Incorporated, which is applying to the FCC to take over WIFE-FM, also lost a court appeal to keep the station on the air beyond midnight. Indianapolis Broadcasting owns WIFE-AM 1310. Don Burden, operator of the outlets, asked the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals here for a stay of the FCC ruling, but was turned down. The commission revoked the licenses of the stations on January 30, 1975, because of misconduct by Burden. He was charged with a long list of violations that include phony contests on the air, double billing of advertisers, slanted news broadcasts, and giving some political candidates airtime without charging them. On one occasion, the FCC said Burden planned to pay off Vancouver officials for a zoning change for KISN, but the change was made fortuitous before any money changed hands, said the FCC. An FCC spokesman said that the agency had to wait 30 days before deciding to grant any temporary permits to broadcast over the radio frequencies. The commission is aware of the possible disruption to the public and will make every effort to return expeditiously these facilities to the air on an interim basis pending the ultimate selection of licensees, said the FCC. The commissioner says there were numerous other stations operating in the three cities, lessening the public impact. The commission ruled last July 27th against Burden's appeal to allow the stations to continue operating after midnight. Nothing was presented in the latest request that has not previously been considered in any detail by the commission, the FCC said. WIFE's problems with the Federal Communications Commission started in 1964, just a few months after Don Burden's Star Stations, owner of stations in Omaha and Vancouver, purchased the former WISH AM and FM. The FCC charged WIFE with misusing ratings information to boost its sales and gave the station a one-year renewal rather than the usual 3 years. Over the next 11 years, the FCC found evidence of false billings, fraudulent contests, and illegal political contributions, including giving free advertising time to Senator Vance Hartke. WIFE employees told the commission that they had been ordered to destroy records, and the station's news director testified that he had been told by management to slant the station's news coverage to favor Hartke, who was seeking re-election in 1964. Still, the FCC continued to renew WIFE's license. However, in the early 1970s, a local group filed a competing application for the WIFE AM license. In 1973, an FCC law judge ruled in favor of that group, so Burden appealed to the full commission. The FCC stripped Burden of all his licenses in 1975, giving WIFE-FM to the local group, Indianapolis Broadcasting, and ordering WIFE and all the other Burden stations off the air. On September 2, 1976, WIFE-FM shut down, saluting Burden with the playing of Frank Sinatra's My Way before signing off. The Federal Communications Commission rejected a request to allow interim operators because Burden owned WIFE's equipment. The station was off the air until 1984, when a new group with its own studios and equipment came on the air as WTPI-FM.
Ransomware strikes Michigan broadcaster. This story comes from Radio World Magazine, written by Randy J. Stein on October 27, 2014. A report of a ransomware demand on a small market radio broadcaster in Michigan has surfaced. The attack is similar to another one we reported on last week in Louisiana. Sanilac Broadcasting Company in the state's Thumb area says three of its stations were attacked in early September. WMIC-AM 660, WTGV-FM, and WBGV-FM suffered data server problems associated with the CryptoLocker virus, which encrypted their database of music files and resulted in dead air. Stan Graybitz, program director and IT manager for Sanilac Broadcasting in Sandusky, Michigan, said the original source of the virus was tracked to a traffic computer that was connected to the Internet. We think the virus was obtained either through a malicious email or an unauthorized website visit. It was a mapping virus, so it compromised everything on the network, which included the music hard drives, Graybitz said. The broadcaster's iMedia Touch software stopped working when it could no longer read the corrupted files, Graybitz said. We couldn't even open any Word documents on the office computers. It was widespread, he said. Graybitz said when he clicked on the infected data files, a message displayed that directed him to several Internet links, which in turn demanded $100 to $300 in Bitcoin or some other form of electronic payment for a key to unlock the files. Bitcoin is a popular Internet currency favored by CryptoLocker attackers to pay ransom to restore files, according to various media reports. CryptoLocker is a ransomware trojan that targets Microsoft Windows operating systems. Thankfully, I had an off-site backup of all the music files. I retrieved those files and got us back on the air later that same day, Graybitz said. Graybitz said Sanilac Broadcasting has taken steps to secure its broadcast systems from outside attacks by adding additional firewalls and limiting Internet access by employees to approved websites and turning off Internet service after normal business hours. For the DX Audio Service in Lexington, Kentucky, I'm Chris Gay.
Thanks, Chris. At this time, we'd like to present a recording of a paper given by IRCA President and National Radio Club member Phil Bytheway at the International Radio Club of America's recent 50th anniversary convention in Billings. In it, he discusses a presentation by IRCA member Nick Hallpatch on the miniaturization of de-expeditions. Phil also talks about his progress in computer technology from his perspective as a design engineer. Here's Phil, by the way.
Okay, so this particular talk was prepared by Nick Hallpatch. Since he couldn't be here, I volunteered to present it for him. We're going to be talking about de-expeditioning. So typically they go to, de-expeditions involve going to a radio quiet type environment. So here's a picture of, I think he said, one of the beaches up near Victoria that he's gone to. And for the life of me, I can't remember which beach it is, and I was dumb enough not to write it down because I knew what it was. Okay, so in the past, the expeditions involved what he's calling big iron, which is basically a lot of equipment. So we've got three radios here, a phaser in the DXer, not on the picture. So this is sometimes quite a bit of big iron now.
Yeah.
This is what Don Nelson brought to the Grayland de-expeditions.
That was
holy crap. Yes, he did. They're all in compartmental boxes that have a lid. What you see is all, they're all radios.
Yeah, I see.
Each one tuned to a different frequency, feeding a myriad of small disc recorders where he would be recording. So to make it simple, he spent a lot of time planning for de-expeditions.
Yeah.
So he would be sitting there tuning these things around and recording, and it would take him a while to digest all the information afterwards. Much like what the SDR people do now after they sleep through the night and record it.
But they don't need that.
In this case, we didn't sleep through the night. He was up actively contributing to his radios the whole night without necessarily tuning to a particular... Actually, I remember, he did listen. It wasn't all sitting there playing. And of course, in the case of a de-expedition, when you got a room full of DXers all tuning around, if something came up, somebody said, oh, India's coming in on this frequency, he could tune several of his radios to that frequency. And this also allowed him to listen to more than one beverage at a time. In a couple of the expeditions, they would string out two or three wires, one to the east and one to the west and one to the northwest and one to the southwest, maybe even. I'd say this is probably the most impressive de-expedition. I mean, this is analogous to some of the pictures we saw earlier about somebody's Radio Shack. He would bring it along with him. He drove a pickup truck and he had this all in the back. So that if the site didn't have any AC power, which of course is best for quiet.
Yeah.
Heavy equipment included basically long life car radio batteries.
Yeah.
Or truck batteries.
Yeah.
Even the motorcycle batteries were not quite good enough.
No.
That's next.
Run them down there, yeah.
Car truck was helpful. Not the least for, I'm going to sit here and read this. Isn't that terrible? Not the least for tapping into the starting battery. On a couple of expeditions I went on, we went too far on one of our cars. And fortunately, there was a fellow DXer that had a motorcycle, and we jumped off of him in the morning after making it the rental car I had so low we couldn't start it. That's a real live experience with being dumb. Typically, if you're going on, what I was used to when we went out in the California desert was we just parked our cars and we used to set up a table because it didn't rain and whatnot. This obviously is a Northwest de-expedition, in which case you had to be prepared. So most of those wound up being in campers and various other. So I know Bruce used to have a camper and we would run all the wires in through the windows and be DXing on his stove and whatnot. Okay, so we've got our own little FSL plug here. So SDRs with small laptops take up a lot less room than a communication receiver or even a Sony 2010. So this ELAD is a SDR and the laptop, that's all technically all you need except for power. So some the SDRs like the ELAD FDM-S1 are very small, can be powered from the USB connector. And they also, as you well know, can record the entire band, as long as you have plenty of memory to save it. Right. Bear in mind what they do is they digitize the RF, and then they feed it into a whole bunch of software that does signal processing to identify specific frequencies, so that's how you tune it. You tell the software what frequency to optimize for, and then that's what it does. But this system even requires power. If you want a DX away from AC power, laptops have batteries that only last a couple of hours. So if you want a DX for an extended period, you're back using the lead acid batteries. And a standard cell, gel cell, I guess, weighs 23 pounds. For powering 3 pounds worth of laptops, you won't be hiking through the woods with that. Well, that's probably true. Anyway, this would be a typical setup, I guess, at one point, although I, quite frankly, I've never witnessed this setup. Now, here's what the main thing is. There are now small lithium-ion rechargeable packs that extend the laptops. Useful operating time, and are pretty much well plug and play. And they showed me this to get together.
Pretty much well plug and play.
This example is the Turcom TS282, rated for 33.6 K milliamp hours, 6.5 by 5 by 0.8, weighs 2 pounds.
That's certainly better than a car battery, and probably better on your back and mine.
Super product rating may be downright misleading, that is, but the TS282 ran a laptop for using an i3 processor for full power for 9 hours, running the FDM S1 software and hardware as well.
The point he's trying to make here is that milliamp hours is current times time, okay? If you draw more current, you have less time. You draw less current, you have more time. So someone can look at this and say, gee, I can run this thing for forever almost because the number is so big, but you really have to do the math. Like I said earlier, it's power that counts, and power and time.
It also helps to dim your screen if you need to leave your laptop on to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And cut the volume on the monitor speakers. Even that draws current that you don't need to
probably
pull out of it.
Headphones.
Yeah.
Longer times should be expected while recording the band. Longer run times should be expected while recording the band with the laptop blank. Well,
or using the, end it all program to kill extraneous stuff that's running on your PC while you're attempting to basically focus on recording the band. So that's my plug for End It All, apparently. Oh. Just found out about that. It will actually kill processes running on your computer that are not doing anything, that because of the way people write software these days, which is like, oh, you want to have it one nanosecond after you click on it. If you don't mind waiting 2 seconds for more CPU time when you're trying to do something you really want to do, I think I'll wait the 2 seconds to start up the program again instead of... But a lot of these programs have background stuff running so you can turn them on quick. It's like the instant-on TVs. You know, everybody here is old enough to know that in the past you turn the TV on and go get coffee and come back and then it would be... And you could see a picture. Anything that's running on a computer takes CPU time, period. It takes memory, too. Memory which could be used to run other stuff. Yes, Mike?
The thing is, though, if you don't see the picture or you don't see what's going on, it kind of makes it more difficult.
Well,
I suggested you dim the computer screen, Mike. You can still see it, but you can throttle
it. If you're actually tuning around, I would agree. But I think some of these setups would be something you could set up and start the recording and then go take a nap. And you can replay these SDR recordings as if you were there and tune around on them just like you were there. As a matter of fact, you can replay the top of the hour as many times as you want to get every possible frequency ID.
Does anyone know any here? Because I don't have an SDR receiver. But the thing about it is someone has one, and let's say it's a good night for TPs or domestic, whatever you're using. It's a good night, and you are glued to the radio the whole night. So you got all this to play back, these frequencies. How long does it take an average person to listen back to that file?
About a winter. I'm not kidding. It takes for, because every time you find one you don't know, then you start working on it, you know, with all the beautiful.
Can you set it up to record like 2 minutes before the hour to 2 minutes after you, or do you have to do the whole spectrum for 6 hours?
No, there's with the Perseus, there's utilities that you can buy that, is it Mechstore? Anybody?
I don't know.
I think that's right. Yeah, you could buy utilities that'll start.
So you can like the 4-hour window there at the top of the hour.
Yeah.
Is where most stations ID.
Right.
And that's what I do on a timer and an old cassette recorder.
Exactly.
When I do that, it'll come on at 58, go off at 02, or maybe. If I may run it till 7 if they're running local weather, so I get another shot at the ID.
When we're chasing local sunrise, I do half hours as well, because you're already coming out of the gray line, and sometimes there'll be some ID at the half hour that's gone when you get to the top of the next hour. So I do exactly what you said, 4 minutes there, 4 minutes at the bottom.
It still takes a long time to digest it all.
Because you're going through the whole band.
Yeah.
From 5:30 to 1700.
Yeah, obviously you would skip your locals.
Yeah. Well, depending on where you are, if you're out in the middle where Nick is or Greylett or something, you don't have any locals.
Well, but with the displays on the SDRs, you can actually see the carriers. You can see if there's something there.
Yeah.
So if it's nice and flat. We're trying to get away from electrical noise, especially on the expeditions. And laptop computers and lithium batteries use internal switching power supplies because they're more efficient and generate electrical noise. Does everyone know what a switching power supply is? Basically, it's a big capacitor. I'm going to make it simple. It's a big capacitor which the voltage feeding it is switched on and off. So it squirts some electrons and stops more to provide the voltage that is the power supply generates. And of course it's smoothing and whatnot to keep it constant. But basically it's turning the mains off and on to generate the power. Whereas in the past there was a big transformer that said 110 on one side, 5 volts or whatever on the other side, and a couple of capacitors to smooth it out. That's the way they used to be. That's a non-switching supply, which is unfortunately not as efficient as switching. Basically, it's like a bucket brigade. Everybody's got a bucket full of electrons and you throw it on and off. And between each person, things are switched off and back on again. And it's done by virtue of an oscillator running at some frequency. And I don't know if you understand this, but square waves have harmonics up the wazoo. Mm-hmm. Every odd multiple of a square wave is basically the same frequency times 3 times 5 times 7, so it generates harmonics all the way up there, which is the switching part of the switching supply. I probably spent too much time on that. Anyway, the idea is that switching supplies are used in just about everything now, and they generate noise just by virtue of the way it's designed. So if you have an old non-switching supply, it would definitely be quieter, because all it really does is change the voltage and smooth it out.
Initial tests were used only in the laptop's internal battery. Okay, so here is what he's going to be showing us from now on, is sort of like how to deal with the noise, or is the noise really there?
These cell phone extender batteries, the small ones, if you could power the SDR separately from the computer, A, you lower the noise.
You are stealing my thunder.
I'll shut up then. And B, you extend the computer life.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, don't worry about it. So from now on we're going to talk about the scenario where he uses it as laptop battery, internal battery, the one that basically runs out, and SDR power. Antenna was a Wellbrook L100, just so that he had the same antenna for all the experiments. Dave Eichelman found that using separate power for the active antenna solved a number of noise problems. His advice was followed. Best way to detect system noise was to use a 100 ohm resistor in place of the small looped antenna. Basically, a 100 ohm resistor is essentially no antenna. So what you're really seeing is how much noise is picked up by your system.
Some signals and presumably noise still crept through below. All these little peaks are signals.
The one in the middle is, what did he say it was? I knew someone was going to ask. It's 1070, Victoria. Being how Nick lives in Victoria.
So all the other little peaks, this is basically from,
what did I figure it was? Well, the center frequency was 1050, and each division is 200.
Well, that's his only local.
So it's the broadcast band, as seen from Victoria, with a 100 ohm resistor as an antenna. the antenna being connected, look at the boosted noise floor of 8 dB to 10 dB. So here he connects an antenna, which is that ALA-100 active antenna. So you can see the difference. Yeah, see, I asked him about this. He didn't do this, but you can see how the noise floor, not only are there more signals, and they're stronger, but the noise floor has also gone up. And of course, if there are signals in that noise, you will not see them. So I hope everyone's kind of switched from normal tuning band to this is the whole band mode. So we're talking about the entire AM band here being shown, and the noise.
Look at the splatter in between there too.
The noise basically went from down here to up here, just by putting the antenna on.
Yeah, it's a minus 120 from.
So it's gone up.
About 8 dB, I guess.
Yeah. So, is problem solved? Signals made will overlay any computer noise? Not entirely. Even when using the laptop battery, you will hear mysterious carriers and hiss that could interfere with your DX. And we're talking about some of that switching noise we talked about and mixing products that probably you don't like. Hiss is apparently insidious because it sounds like a noise floor and you have no inkling that you could hear better than you're doing already. Basically, what he's saying is that you tune around, you hear a noise, but what are you really hearing? Are you hearing radio noise, or are you hearing something that is not part of the band you're trying to, the frequency you're tuned to? It's likely noise is conveyed along the antenna cable sheet and radiated to the antenna. So, and most people use coax, which is basically a center conductor with a shield around it. The shield is going to get noise RF from the outside, and we've got this distance you can barely see between the shield and the actual wire that's going to your radio, so that there will be noise communicated across that barrier. Even though it's an insulator, there still will be stuff communicated. Common mode chokes can reduce such signals. They are a topic for another talk, unfortunately. Homebrew one is shown below between the FDM S1 and the antenna interface. This is a split screen. The top portion of the waterfall shows 10 dB more noise using the laptop's internal battery and a dummy load on the antenna, which I guess the 100 ohms we mentioned before, and does the same system using a common mode choke. So the common mode choke takes this noise and cancels it out to some extent that we talked about being induced from the shield to the, so it's quieter. Does using the Turcom auxiliary battery introduce noise? Okay. Not with the common mode choke in place, and the darker line across the center shows the difference between, it's basically the same picture as we saw last time, except it's the choke is in and we're switching between the Turcom auxiliary battery and the other battery we used before. And essentially, there is no difference between the two, because it basically looks the same below the line as it does above the line. I already said that, didn't I? No change. Next. To conclude, which I thought was going to be longer than this, use of potentially noisy equipment such as laptop computers, clever backup batteries, and SDRs may introduce electrical noise to your receiver signal when on a de-expedition. Now, everyone knows that being away from your locals and all the dimmers and fish tank heaters and transformers that the electrical company hasn't fixed yet and whatnot, you're going to get rid of all that by going somewhere. But see, this talk technically addresses, so you're there now, how can we do this better? And not only that, but lightweight. Using a common mode choke, separate power supply, or battery for an active antenna can reduce noise levels to where it is not a concern. So the goal is that the noise is so low that if a signal is there, you'll hear it, or at least in the waterfall display, you'll see it. And because, as I'm sure you can imagine, if there was a signal that wasn't as loud as the noise, you wouldn't even know it was there. Take advantage of technologies lifting of size and weight restraints on equipment. Do some serious DXing in isolated locations or on vacation. Yes, backup batteries can travel in carry-on luggage on planes. So the battery technology appears to be good enough to last on the whole night's worth of DXing. Truly isolated locations at dusk or dawn still need to be tested properly. So the conclusions drawn here were basically based on one experiment at one site, And so he thinks that maybe you can find sites that are quieter initially. He hasn't done that yet. Still some weak signals waiting out there, and we don't want them covered with noise, which is essentially what I said earlier. Are there any questions?
When we go out in the desert next week, that's right there. Nick's last point is the first thing we're going to be doing is trying to do the same drill he took here and go through and figure out in a really quiet place whether there are some mechanisms there that can be improved, such as these DX engineering, current balance, maybe, you know, we don't know. We're going to try everything.
Did he give you a list?
Yeah. I got a list right here.
So essentially what we just talked about is that the fact that it looks like the technology has allowed us to be a lot more portable, and the SDR technology allows us to basically, in effect, turn everything on and go to sleep. You can tune around if you want, but if you're recording the whole band, you can listen to it later, and as Pat brought out, may take days to find out what you heard. But just like any technology, I mean, everyone here might remember when calculators came out. Well, the first ones were like $900 from HP, and they did all sorts of things. And
Dixie tubes.
2 years later, you could buy one for $10 from Texas Instruments that did almost all the same thing.
And they only added...
And more.
They only added subtracted, multiply, and divide.
So I can give my little NRE speech, which people out there in the real world don't... NRE is called non-recurrent engineering. And it's the money that company spends up front to develop a product, which they generally do on their own nickel.
That's right.
And so when something new and interesting comes out, it's almost always going to be expensive because the company wants to get their NRE back. And the only way to get it back is to charge 10 times what it really costs to make it. So you, and it's good because they get the money back, they feel good, they design something else that's even better, and they do the same thing over and over again. The best analogy I could come up with was the one with calculators, because I know that they were real expensive to begin with, the little pocket ones that run off batteries, and all of a sudden they became cheap. Well, everybody got their NRE back,
or
so
VCRs.
They said, now we're going to sell it for what it really costs.
Are there any new companies coming out with these SDR radios? I mean, we know some of the larger ones now, like Perseus and Elad and...
I don't know the answer to that question. But I'm sure if you mentioned that on an e-group, there are a number of people like Nick and Guy Atkins. And
there's an Israeli SDR. I can't tell you the model number on it, really? But I've heard about that. Yeah.
But SDRs are going to continue to improve until they get a point where it maybe doesn't make sense to improve them. But right now, well, the other technology that they use in SDRs is ADD converters, because they're digitizing the RF band. ADD converters get better. They get more bits. You understand digital, each bit represents a certain voltage. And so the more bits you have, the better accuracy and voltage you can turn into a digital word. And along with memories, ADD converters get better. I mean, the first MP3s and waves and whatnot probably sound pretty crappy now compared to what you can get. Things do get better. Memories get better. I thought that at one point memories were going to stop getting more dense, but they've apparently come up with some new techniques. I used to be in the integrated circuit technology as an engineer, and I watched it go from so many microns to a tenth of that just over the course of my career designing integrated circuits. The smaller, I mean, they used to use photographic techniques to decide where to put the metal on ICs. Well, now it's all done with lasers because the lasers are more accurate. Putting a stencil on a silicon wafer and shining a light on it, which was a photographic method, they put the goo down and they use a laser to expose it, if that's the right word, and they can get higher densities that. And then of course they're doing a whole lot more stuff. Probably since I've been out of the IC design, things are probably better, but I do know that based on my experience, memories get denser, and as I said, ADDs get better. And both those technologies are good and bad. They're good because they allow us to, in effect, record the whole band versus a short range of frequencies. When we record the whole band with the better ADDs, you actually get more stuff to play with, which means you need more computer power to analyze it. I mean, it's a lot easier to analyze a 16-bit word than it is a 24-bit word. I mean, SDRs basically digitize the band, and then they run a whole bunch of FFTs and other signal processing algorithms on them. But you see, there's no analog in there at all, except power supply. And hopefully, unfortunately, since switching supplies are more noisy, they're almost always used exclusively. That's why we were talked a little bit about switching noise. It's amazing what I ran into through my whole career of doing this stuff. First workstation we got, it like 1/100th of what the ones do now. But the ones do now have 100 times faster processors and maybe even 100 times more memory. Because like I say, the people can write software a whole lot faster than they can generate more denser memory. And we'll switch over to my opinion here. People who write software are no longer concerned about the things that some of us were concerned about when we had TRS-80s and whatnot. Writing efficient code, because they figure they got memory up the wazoo, they got CPU time up the wazoo, or actually down to the wazoo. They can write cumbersome code all they want, and it's no big deal. So the file's bigger, well, you got more memory to put it on. So it takes a little bit longer to run. Well, nobody's gonna notice because it's faster than the last version. And I've worked with software to the point where I know that they don't think about writing efficient code, because the way they're taught how to write software does not discuss that anymore. Those of us who were in computers when it started know that writing efficient code works faster, uses less memory, et cetera, et cetera. That's not a worry now because, oh, we got lots of memory. We got lots of CPU speed. So the people designing computers are focusing on making them faster. And they've already pretty much run into a brick wall, which is why we have the duals and the quads. Basically, we have three or four computers all running at the same time with somebody arbitrating on who gets what to run. So it's faster by virtue of the fact that you're splitting up what needs to be done, not because the computers themselves are faster. Everybody who's bought new computers knows that the new operating systems, they do more. Now, I don't want to discount the software people because, quite frankly, as more and more untrained people, I'm not trying to be nice, as more and more people who don't really understand computers use computers, they make more mistakes and do stupid things. Software people have to write code to look for that kind of thing and not do it. So they actually have to add code in their software to prevent dum-dums from doing things that might crash the system or erase the hard drive or something. So that stuff's in the software now. Now, before, or in the dim times when I started writing software, we never considered somebody doing something dumb. We figured that the people who were using the computers knew what they were doing. Quite frankly, at that point, most of them did. But now it's gone out to everybody. Everybody's got a computer, right? And so the software people have to write stuff to make sure that bad things don't happen. And that actually consumes memory and CPU time. So it's no surprise if you get a new operating system and it runs slow. And it's no surprise that all of a sudden there's a new laptop coming out at the same time as the operating system, because they want to make it seem like it's running about the same. But what they're really doing is running faster with more memory, bigger code, which looks the same as what they did before. There's nothing around that. You can't prevent people from doing dumb things. I mean, even some of us have tuned to the wrong frequency or remembered to tune back to 640 at 3 o'clock at 5 minutes after. Oops. I was going to go back there and catch that ID from that station that was there a half hour ago. It was really loud, but they were doing network programming and figured, well, the only time I'm going to hear any kind of ID is at the top of the hour. So you tune around and do something else, and all of a sudden it's 5 minutes past it. Oops, I forgot. So people do that, and I'm afraid the people who pay for the people that do that are us.
Phil, by the way, from the 2014 IRCA convention in Billings. Our next article is not so much radio-related as it is radio-listener-related. We wonder what has changed over the past couple of decades. Why we are the way we are. Here at the DX Audio Service, we used to get many submissions from members and participating in the process of putting together the magazine. Now it seems like our members are just listeners. They don't care to participate. They just want to listen. What has changed? Are we getting more apathetic? Has social media perhaps changed our perceptions of what we listen to? Is that why we don't care about issues in radio? Mark Durnberger has an interesting article that may offer an insight to why we are the way we are. And hopefully we can find some time to be members and participate and get off our smartphones, Facebook, and Twitter. Mark?
This is an interview about how we react as people react with each other. It's called The Networked Primate, and it's an interview by Mark Fischetti that recently appeared in Scientific American. It begins, "For the first time in the history of our species, we are never alone and never bored. Have we lost something fundamental about being human? Chances are that you have a smartphone, a Facebook page, and a Twitter account, and that you found yourself ignoring a friend or family member who is in the same room as you because you're totally engrossed in your social technology. That technology means never having to feel alone or bored. Yet, ironically, it can make us less attentive to the people closest to us and even make it hard for us to simply be with ourselves. Many of us are afraid to make this admission. We're still in a romance with these technologies," says Sherry Turkle of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. "We're like young lovers who are afraid that talking about it will spoil it." Turkle has interviewed at length hundreds of individuals of all ages about their interactions with smartphones, tablets, social media, avatars, and robots. Unlike previous disruptive innovations such as the printing press or television, the latest always-on, always-on-you technology, she says, threatens to undermine some basic human strengths that we need to thrive. In the conversation that follows, which has been edited for Space and Time, Turkle explains her concerns as well as her cautious optimism that the youngest among us could actually resolve the challenges. S.A., what concerns you most about our constant interaction with our social technologies? Turkle, one primary change I see is that people have a tremendous lack of tolerance for being alone. I do some of my field work at stop signs, at checkout lines, at supermarkets. Give people even a second, they're doing something with their phone. Every bit of research says people's capacity to be alone is disappearing. What can happen is that you lose that moment to have a daydream or to cast an eye inward. Instead, you look to the outside. Children especially need solitude. Solitude is the precondition for having a conversation with yourself. This capacity to be with yourself and discover yourself is the bedrock of development. But now, from the youngest age, even 2 or 3 or 4, children are given technology that removes solitude by giving them something externally distracting. That makes it harder, ironically, to form true relationships. Maybe people just don't want to be bored. Well, people talk about never needing to have a lull. As soon as it occurs, they look at the phone, they get anxious. They haven't learned to have conversations or relationships which involve lulls. Are we valuing relationships less then? People start to view other people in part as objects. Imagine two people on a date. Hey, I have an idea. Instead of our just looking at each other face to face, why don't we each wear Google Glass? So if things get a little dull, I can just catch up on my email, and you won't know. This disrupts the family, too. When boring auntie starts to talk at the family dinner table, her little niece pulls out her phone and goes on Facebook. All of a sudden, her world is populated with snowball fights and ballerinas, and dinner is destroyed. Dinner used to be the utopian ideal of the American family, having a canonical 3-generation gathering. Facebook is what's utopian now. What about people who take their phones to bed? They're asleep, so why would they feel alone? I've interviewed enough middle school and high school kids, so tell me, do you answer your texts in the middle of the night? Oh yeah, I call it, I share, therefore I am, as a style of being. If you're sharing in the middle of the night and responsive to people in the middle of the night, you're in a different zone. And all these people feel responsible to respond. The expectation is constant access. Everyone is ready to call in the advice and the consent of their peers. I'm doing a case study of a young woman who has 2,000 followers on Instagram. She'll ask about a problem at 9 o'clock at night, and at 2 o'clock in the morning she's getting responses, and she's awake to get those responses. This is 2 o'clock in the morning for a lot of kids. So where does this lead for someone who lives this way? If you don't call a halt to it, I think you don't fully develop a sense of an autonomous self. You're not able to be in personal relationships, business relationships, because you don't feel fully competent to handle major things on your own. You run into trouble if you're putting everything up ultimately for a vote. In other words, you're crowdsourcing your life. You're crowdsourcing major decisions. I hope it's likely, however, that a person reaches a point where they're on a job, they're not 20-something, they're 30-something, and this starts to become less comfortable, and they develop emotional skills that they really haven't worked on to that point. What about our interactions with automated personalities and robots? When we started looking at this in the 1970s, people took the position that even if simulated thinking might be thinking, simulated feeling was not feeling. Simulated love was never love. But that's gone away. People tell me that if Siri could fool them a little better, they'd be happy to talk to Siri as a friend. Isn't that like the movie Her? Absolutely. The current position seems to be that if there's a robot that could fool me into thinking that it understands me, I'm good to have it as a companion. This is a significant evolution in what we ask for in our interactions, even on intimate matters. I see it in kids. I see it in grown-ups. The new robots are designed to make you feel as though you're understood. Yet nobody is pretending that any of them understands anything. So, Ms. Turkle, what line does that cross? That there's no empathy? There's no authentic exchange. You're saying empathy is not important to the feeling of being understood, and yet I interviewed a woman who said to me she's okay with a robot boyfriend. She wants one of those sophisticated Japanese robots. I looked at her and said, "You know that it doesn't understand you." She said, "Look, I just want civility in the house. I just want something that will make me feel not alone." People are also good with a robot that could stand in as a companion for an older person, but I take a moral position here because older people deserve to tell the story of their life to someone who understands what a life is. They've lost spouses, they've lost children. We're suggesting they tell the story of their life to something that has no idea what a life is or what a loss is. It's crucial to understand that this changing interaction is not just a story about technology. It's a story about how we are evolving when we're faced with something passive. I hope we're going to look closer at people's willingness to project humanity into a robot and to accept a facade of empathy as the real thing, because I think such interactions are a dead end. We want more from technology and less from each other? Really? Well, do avatars and virtual reality present the same issues? In these cases, we're moving from life to the mix of your real life and your virtual life. One young man put it very succinctly. He said, "Real life is just one window, and it's not necessarily my best one." People forgot about virtual reality for a while, but now the acquisition of Oculus by Facebook raises it again. Mark Zuckerberg's fantasy that you will meet up with your friends in a virtual world where everybody looks like Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. You live in a beautiful home and you present only what you want to present. We're evolving toward thinking of that as a utopian image. But skeptics say your avatar is not different from the real you. Well, we do perform all the time. I'm trying to do my best, Jerry Turkle, right now, but it's a little different from me hanging out in my pajamas. What's different with an avatar or on Facebook is that you get to edit. A woman posts a photo of herself and then works on the color in the background and the lighting. Why? Because she wants it a certain way. We've never before been able to have it the way we wanted it. And now we can. People love that. I asked an 18-year-old man, "What's wrong with conversation?" He said, "It takes place in real time. You can't control what you're going to say." This was profound. That's also why a lot of people like to do their dealings on email. It's not just the time shifting. It's that basically you can get it right. Another question. One reason for the rise of humans is that functioning in groups gives each member a better chance to succeed. Will the move toward living online undermine those benefits? Oh, that is the question before us. Are we undermining or are we enhancing our competitive advantage? A lot of my colleagues would say we're enhancing it. The internet is giving us new ways of getting together, forming alliances, but I think we're at a point of inflection. While we were infatuated with the virtual, we dropped the ball on where we actually live. We need to balance how compelling the virtual is with the realities that we live in our bodies and on this planet. It's so easy for us to look the other way. Are we going to get out there and make our real communities what they should be? Sherry, your critics say there's nothing to worry about because this new technology situation is not really new. We went through this with television. You know, TV is there to watch your kids so you don't have to. First of all, television can be a group exercise. I grew up in a family that sat around a TV and watched it together, fought about what was on the TV, commented on it together. But when everybody watches their own show in their own room, so to speak, that stops. Technology that is always on and always on you, that is a quantum leap. I agree that there have been quantum leaps before. The book, The difference with always on, however, is that I really don't have a choice. You mean you could turn off the TV and still function? I can't live my professional life or my personal life without my phone or my email. My students can't even obtain their syllabus without it. We don't have an opt-out option from a world with this technology. The question is, how are we going to live a more meaningful life with something that is always on and always on you? And wait until it's in your ear, in your jacket, in your glasses. So how do we resolve that? I think it's going to develop as some sort of common practice. I think companies will get involved, realizing it isn't actually good for people to be constantly connected. Our etiquette will get involved. Today, if I get a message and don't get back to people in 24 hours, they're worried about me, or they're mad that I haven't replied. Why? I think we'll change our expectation of having constant access. Well, any suggestions for how we can get started? One argument I make is that there should be sacred spaces, the family dinner table, the car. Make the use of the places for conversation, because conversation is the antidote to a lot of the issues I'm describing. If you're talking to your kids, if you're talking to your family, if you're talking to a community, these negative effects don't arise as much. And we should be talking more about the technologies. My message is not anti-technology. It's pro-conversation and pro-the human spirit. It's really about calling into question our dominant culture of more, better, faster. We need to assert what we need for our own thinking, for our own development, and for our relationships with our children, with our communities, with our intimate partners. As for the robots, I'm hoping that people will realize that what we're really disappointed in is ourselves. It's so upsetting to me. We're basically saying that we're not offering one another the conversation and companionship. That really is the justification for talking to a robot you know doesn't understand a word you're saying. And we're letting each other down in the process. It's not about the robots, it's about us. So who is going to stop this train we're on? Well, the most optimistic thing I see is young people who have grown up with this technology but aren't smitten by it, who are willing to say, hold on a second. They see the ways in which it's undermined life at school and life with their parents. This is where I'm guardedly hopeful. I have so many examples of children who will be talking with their parents. Something will come up, and the parent will go online to search, and the kid will say, Daddy, stop Googling. I just want to talk to you. When I go to the city parks, I see kids go to the top of the jungle gym and call out, Mommy, Mommy, and they're being ignored. They object to being ignored when they're 5, 8, or 9. But when I interview these kids, when they're 13, 14, or 15, they become reflective. They say, I'm not going to bring up my children the way I'm being brought up. They're going to have rules like no phones at dinner. I also see evidence that dealing with some of this technology is feeling to them like work, the whole notion that you have to constantly keep up your Facebook profile. So I think there's every possibility that the children will lead us. They see the costs. They think, I don't have to give up this technology, but maybe I could be a little smarter about it. And that interview was by Mark Fischetti, a senior editor at Scientific American, and the person speaking for the most part was Sherry Turkle, a vocation sociologist at MIT. For the DX Audio Service, Mark Dernberger.
Thanks, Mark. And we hope that you, the membership, the subscribers of this magazine, get more involved with us. That's it for this edition of the DX Audio Service, a special 3-CD edition of the DX Audio Service for December 2014. Remember, you can comment on stories you hear or things that you hear on your radio by calling the Musings line at 419-741-0205. You can write to us or email us. We'd love to hear from you. Until our next edition, have a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and be sure to have a safe and sane New Year. We'll see you in 30 days with more DX stuff. Remember, get out and support radio.